This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In. Coming up, Vigo County's popular vote has aligned with that of every elected president of the last 132 years, except two. The race hasn't been called yet, but has that streak continued based on where things are going so far? And back in 2016, when then-President-elect Trump publicly called out Carrier for sending jobs to Mexico and worked out a deal to keep some jobs here, how does that look 4 years later? And I talked to our education reporter about how Indiana education referendums did on Tuesday. But first, a look at the week's news from our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So it's been election week. So it has been a busy week. But first, we've got to look at the COVID-19 numbers because things are not looking good. For the fifth, sixth week in a row now.
Yeah, fifth or sixth week is probably about right. As of noon, 4,306 people have died from COVID-19, which is not including the probable deaths. We had a new milestone today, crossing 200,000 confirmed cases with more than 1.7 million Hoosiers tested. And today's 4,714 new COVID-19 cases is yet another record-setting case number. It's the third this week, the second day in a row with more than 4,000 cases, and the 11th record-setting case, record-breaking case number since we moved to stage five. Over the last week, 256 deaths were reported from COVID-19. That's back into early May numbers, which for context, our peak for the number of deaths was in late April. So that's paired with nearly 25,000 new positive COVID-19 cases in just the last 7 days. And on top of all of that, more than 2,000 Hoosiers are currently hospitalized with COVID-19, the most since ISDH started releasing that data, and also the first time that we've crossed 2,000. Indiana's seven-day average has increased by 317% since the state moved to stage five, which means we've more than quadrupled the seven-day average from September 26th to today. In the same time period, 31 counties have more than doubled their number of reported cases, and Fountain, Park, and Warren counties have all seen their totals triple. And even compared to our neighbors in the Midwest, we are doing far worse, even when taking into account population.
Oh, really? I see. That was going to be my next question. How are we doing compared to the rest of the nation? I guess if we look around, Indiana isn't doing great compared to what, say, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio. Do we have any comparisons?
Yeah. Nikki Kelly from the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette yesterday tweeted out those averages as of yesterday. Indiana, I think, is the earliest in the day for releasing their daily numbers. Ohio doesn't do theirs until 2, and Illinois doesn't until 5. But as of yesterday, per 100,000 residents, Indiana had a rate at 66.2. Illinois came in at 60.4 because of Chicago more than anything else. And then everybody else was in the 40s or 30s.
Aha. Uh-huh. And I know we want to get to election results, but along those lines on COVID-19, even though things are looking not the way we want them to, has the governor said anything about changing his approach?
No. To say the very least, these numbers are in the absolute wrong direction on every single metric. Even going back to the state's map of that ranking system that they have, the whole state is orange right now. On Wednesday, just after winning his substantial reelection victory, Governor Holcomb said that wasn't going to would have no impact on his decision making around COVID-19. He repeated that he doesn't believe reimposing statewide COVID-19 restrictions will effectively curb the virus's spread. Leading up to the election, I'd heard a number of rumors from folks that, you know, the day after the election, Governor Holcomb's going to drag us all back to stay-at-home orders or to, you know, earlier or more previous reopening stages. And of course, that is not the case based on Holcomb's reaction on Wednesday. And he's faced sharp criticism from both his political left and right over the handling of the pandemic. In response to those questions on Wednesday, he said politics didn't drive his decisions before the election and will not after the election.
But the criticisms from the left and the right look pretty starkly different regarding COVID-19, though. Am I wrong about that?
No, absolutely correct. Generally speaking, the right feels that he overreached with his responses to the pandemic, that he did not have the legal authority to institute the stay-at-home orders that were enacted by other states all across the country, nor did he have the authority to issue a mask mandate that is not a mandate. It is a suggestion with education from health departments. And then on the left, people believe that he should have done more to curb the spread, or that we should have maintained a certain spot in the reopening plans, that the way that the reopening plans were structured did not account for people who didn't believe that the virus was real.
Okay. Let's get to the election. Of course, Governor Holcomb was... On a lighter note, if you can imagine that, Governor Holcomb did win re-election. What else do we know about the election?
Yeah, Holcomb, as you said, won his re-election. His victory actually marks the fifth straight gubernatorial win for Republicans. Indiana Democrats have not won a governor's race since 2000. As of Friday, Holcomb had captured more than 700,000 votes than Democrat Dr. Woody Myers. So to say that it was not close is a gross understatement. And then for the Attorney General's race, Republican Todd Rokita won on Tuesday as well, beating Democrat Jonathan Weinzapfel. Rokita, of course, former Secretary of State and four-term congressman, secured Republican control over the statewide office for the sixth consecutive election. Democrats have not won that position since 1996. And before election results began to trickle in on Tuesday, Rokita's campaign actually announced that the attorney general-elect had tested positive for COVID-19. So he was not at any of the party watch parties or anything like that. He had maintained his distance. They had announced Tuesday afternoon. So he'd been isolating since before that.
I understand he had a few symptoms. Do we know anything about how he's doing?
No, it seems to be fairly mild symptoms and seems to be fine. We haven't really heard much up on that front. And we also heard that he did not contract the virus while at a campaign event. It appeared to be some other venue in which he had contracted the virus.
And do you have anything? I think what's really significant about the gubernatorial race is the influence of Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater. Do you have any information on the numbers that he was able to pull in on Tuesday?
Yeah, trying to find that. Yes. So as of 1:14 p.m., so a minute ago, Donald Rainwater had captured 11.5% of the vote. And so that's about 350,000 votes, which is not insignificant by any stretch of the imagination. Brandon has, our State House reporter, Brandon Smith, certainly has more background on the Libertarian influence, but it certainly seemed to play a role, especially leading up to the election. And I think that a lot of tea leaf readers would have assumed that his influence in the election would have drawn more votes away from Holcomb than Dr. Woody Myers, but it seemed to have a less substantial impact on the race overall.
Still, double digits for a Libertarian candidate. Very, very interesting development indeed. And if you go back to Wednesday's show, the day after the election, I did talk with Brandon Smith quite a bit about Donald Rainwater's numbers that he had pulled down. And I think they looked a little different then that early on. But still, we're in the double digits percentage-wise for Donald Rainwater. And Brandon had some good insight on that. Now, speaking, coming back to COVID-19, did COVID-19 seem to influence the election in any way?
I mean, just yeah, probably. It's kind of hard to, it's kind of hard to break that down. I can say that with some certainty that it did impact at least folks being able to vote. In the 2 weeks leading up to Election Day, there were more than 37,000 Hoosiers who tested positive for COVID-19. There was really only one form of recourse for folks who wanted to vote but did not have, but couldn't go to polls because they had tested positive for the virus, which was ordering a traveling board. But even then, there was a deadline the day before the election in order to get that. And on Election Day, we had had more than 3,000. I think we had had more than 3,000 new cases reported then. And traveling election boards are a little bit wonky and not nearly as well known as, you know, absentee ballots or you know, in-person early voting. So Barbara Anguiano did a really cool story on Election Day about a specific voter who was unable to vote because of the virus. In her story, she also talked to Anthony Long, who is the vice chair of the Indiana Election Commission. And he said he was frustrated that the state didn't take action sooner to avoid the situation. And Long said voters who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 in this 11th hour echo some of the frustrations of those on the board. And he said one of the commission's biggest accomplishments was the distribution of PPE to polling sites across the state. But he also said that the power to expand vote by mail, to do a lot of things that would have mitigated some of that disenfranchisement really was left up to executive leadership from the governor or from the state legislature.
All right. Got about 30 seconds left. How did down ballot races look?
Yeah, Republicans grew their supermajority by four seats, including Representatives Chris Chung and Lisa Beck, who were both defeated by Republican lawmakers they previously had beat in 2018. Democrats were only able to defeat a single House Republican, Representative Cindy Kirkhofer out of Beech Grove. And in the Senate, Democrats were able to pick up a seat as Senator John Ruckel's House lost his seat out of Indianapolis to a person who will be the first Muslim state legislator.
All right. It's been a busy week for you. You're our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, did Vigo County do it again? The bellwether county that's correctly predicted every U.S. president for the last 132 years, except for two. I'm Matt Pelser. We'll take a look in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Since 1888, the voters of one Indiana county have been in alignment with the rest of the country all but two times when it comes to electing U.S. presidents. Joining me now is the chair of the Political Science Department at Indiana State University, Matt Bergbauer. Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So what county are we talking about?
I live in Vigo County. I work in Vigo County as a professor at Indiana State. And then I vote in Vigo County, which is a bellwether county.
And so Vigo County, so give me the history here. Vigo County has correctly voted for, I guess, I don't know the term, every U.S. president except for two in the last 130 or so years?
That's correct. So we have a good streak of a popular vote winner in the county matching the Electoral College winner of the nation. And that streak is consistent to 1956. And we got that election correct too, 1956. But in 1952, we elected in the county Adlai Stevenson. As we know, the nation elected Eisenhower.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And then there was a good 40 years run before that of Vigo County being a good correlation with the nation.
And what was the other one they got wrong?
1908, the county selected William Jennings Bryan, and the nation selected Taft.
Okay. Now we don't yet know the official results of the election as of this recording, and we're recording on Friday morning. But did Vigo County go where we think the nation is going this time?
No, it did not. Vigo County showed a lot of support for Trump in 2016, and much more than the nation's support for Trump. And that happened again this year, where the county supported Trump at about the same amount it did 2016.
So are there other counties in the U.S. with streaks like this?
There is another county that is at the top of the list with Vigo County, and it's a county in New Mexico that's had a just as good a run as Vigo County, maybe a little bit better, but I think they redrew those county lines during the streak, which could, if you're from Vigo County, right, that could, you know, try to disqualify them from the streak.
Okay, so there's that technicality. Is their streak, how similar is their streak, I guess?
Oh, it's just as strong, if not stronger. I can't remember how many decades, you know, their correlation is going. And I don't even know what's going on there for this year. But I'm going to, when the dust settles, right, with this presidential contest at the national level, then I can say with certainty that a bellwether streak continues for certain counties. And for Vigo County, it looks like the bellwether streak is going to end.
Oh, okay. I mean, obviously, this kind of bellwether has been determined through over a century of just happening to get it right. But I don't know. How else can we determine a bellwether, I suppose?
I do have concerns about the measurement of a bellwether. So as I suggested at the beginning of our interview, that the popular vote of our county correlates with the electoral college vote of the nation. Now, there's some fuzzy math going to be in here when it comes to the 2000 election with Al Gore and the 2016 election with Hillary Clinton being popular vote winners but electoral college losers. So if you wanted to measure bellwether by popular vote and maybe share of the electorate, right, the Democratic share versus Republican share of the electorate, I'm starting to think that there are some other counties out there in the nation that are going to be a little bit better at matching on to the nation. So another way to test this is to look at all the Democratic averages across presidential races and all the Republican averages across presidential races, and then see which county kind of matches the as an average with the nation. And I don't know if Vigo County's in the top 10 and the top 100 if you do that type of analysis. But if you take it to the simple analysis, which is who's the Electoral College winner, Republican or Democrat, and then how did the county vote, then yeah, Vigo County is a great bellwether measurement over the past 100 plus years. But as a popular vote share, right, then I'm sure some other counties will top the list.
Now, is this, it sounds to me like it's just an extraordinary coincidence. And this is, and Vigo County, eyes have been on Vigo County for a long time over this. But is it possible that there are other counties in the nation that match this and we just haven't been paying as close attention? I mean, when did we start to notice that Vigo County sort of had this quality about it, I suppose?
Yeah. So, I mean, you say coincidence and others say luck. going back to 2000 and 2016, right, that's you could almost throw out George W. Bush being lucky on how the vote count turned out in Florida. Trump being lucky, how the vote turnout happened in Michigan, right? And Wisconsin, just a fraction of a percentage point difference between the two candidates determined the election outcome. And so Vigo County had a little luck those 2 years when batching onto the nation, for sure. And then when I talk about bellwether to other journalists, I do have a hard time reaching back into history. I'm originally from Illinois, so I moved here for the job, and I'm very happy with my employer and very happy living in the county. It's a great place for me to live, and I do enjoy talking about bellwether every 4 years and observing politics in my community. I teach state and local government, so I like to get involved with what's going on in the city council and county council. And the partisan makeup of the county is interesting to me, too. That's part of my explanation of a bellwether status for our county, is that I see multiple Republicans representing me in the county, and I see multiple Democrats representing me in the county. I can only reserve that for the 21st century, right, for the past 10 to 20 years. I have a harder time explaining what this county was like prior to me really being involved in politics, whether it be in Illinois or in Indiana. I just don't know. I can't put my thumb on it exactly what the political culture of this county was 50 and 60 and 70 years ago, despite the fact that the Bellwether Streak goes back that far. For Adlai Stevenson and James Bryant, one interesting little tidbit about those two is that they're both from Illinois. So they both have Illinois roots. And Vigo County, of course, touches upon Illinois and its western border. And that connection, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but I don't know. It just interests me, I suppose, right? I was interested in their roots in southern Illinois and how that could have inspired maybe a little bit of crossover into Indiana.
Can we talk about how politics and parties have changed over that last 100 or so years with respect to, you know, how they are now? Is there anything there worth mentioning?
Well, we know the demographics of the country have changed quite a bit, and they're mapping on the party IDs at a strong level for some groups in society, right? As we become more diverse nation, particularly with Latinos, and we see their correlation with Democrats becoming stronger and stronger. Now, they're a complex group, Latinos. We recognize that the Cuban Americans were, or at least at the moment, they were pivotal in a Florida victory for Trump. But Mexican Americans in the Southwest are still a strong base for Democrats. And this is things like Nevada and Arizona we can pinpoint as being a good base for Democrats to win races there. So they're a complex group when it comes to correlating with a party ID, but we know that we need to track that minority group across time because they're growing and they've surpassed African Americans as the largest minority group in the country. And they're populated in big cities and they're populated in many southern states and not so much Indiana and definitely not so much Vigo County. So I've always been interested in how the demographics of the country change over time and how it splits with Vigo County and its demographics. So we are a predominantly white county. And then when you look at Trump's core supporters, you see a lot of white males and a lot of white females. That's the exit polls suggest that, and polling across time suggests that his biggest support base is with that group, and that maps onto Vigo County pretty well.
So the demographics of Terre Haute and Vigo County, they just don't match up with the rest of the country, so we can't point to that really at all when it comes to this luck, as you say, of picking the right president over the last 130 years.
Well, for sure, the past five election cycles, that's when I've been tracking the census most closely, right? Mm-hmm. And then comparing it with the nation. So that's probably since 2000. I've really started to look at that closely. And look at income, I look at education levels, race breakdown, of course, and age. When you think of Vigo County, you could identify it as a rural county. Now, the Census Bureau will say Terre Haute's urban.
Right.
But when you drive around Terre Haute and Vigo County, you don't get a sense of urban like in Indianapolis and a Louisville, even a Fort Wayne. So there's a rural culture here. And we know, going back to your question about political landscape over the past 100 years, we know that we're becoming increasingly an urban versus rural political society. Mm. And so you drive around Vigo County, you would think it's rural, and it maps onto all those other rural counties of Indiana and Illinois and the Midwest, and they're red counties, consistently red counties. So Democrats should have a bit of an uphill battle to win this county, and they have to pinpoint an audience of how they can get votes in Vigo County, for example, to be competitive. And because of the fact that we have four institutions of higher education is a good place to start. So I work at Indiana State, 10,000 students consistently across time. Some of them are remote, of course, and some of them live out of the county, but nonetheless, we have dorms on campus, right? And we register people to vote, blah, blah, blah. We have Rose Holman, we have St. Mary of the Woods, and we have a community college all within the county as well that attracts 18 to 22-year-olds to live here. And voter registration drives happen in every community, and this one's included. So local Democrats, and if you have a field office here for running for president, like Barack Obama did in 2008, then you get those young people to register to vote, and you try to get them to vote at the polls on election day because young people lean Democratic. So that's a way for a Democratic strategy to win the county is to really hit the young people that live here in the community.
I understand that part, though, of what may be at work here are so-called peripheral voters. What does that mean?
Oh, sure. That's a political science term that I teach my students sometimes. And I try to characterize an independent voter and the complexities of an independent voter. So we can start off with the notion that that there is a 20% bump in voter turnout from a presidential contest to a midterm contest, right? So we know that there are millions of people out there who are not voting in a midterm, but will vote in a presidential contest. And we wonder who are these 20% of the population? Who are these people? And so apparently they're not strong Democrats or strong Republicans in the sense of, right, they really want to ensure victories on a consistent basis for their party. They could be independents. They could lean towards a party. But maybe if you're something like a Trump supporter, maybe Trump on the ballot is really important to them. And then the Republican Party, less so. That's just one example. They may get wrapped up in the presidential contest, and the media attention that it gets, even in your community, your neighbors, your family members are going to naturally talk about the two finalists for the presidential contest. It just kind of dominates our society and our culture for a couple months. And that could motivate them to turn out when they don't receive that same type of attention in midterm elections. Once again, these are people who are busy as well. They work full time. They may have families. And so midterm elections just don't catch their attention at the same level as a presidential contest. And they could be persuaded by the environment when they vote as well, given the fact that they're not necessarily wedded to a party ID on a consistent basis. So these are things like concerns over terrorism, could be a political landscape that affects them, could be a charismatic candidate like a Reagan who influences their voter choice. And although nationally, you know, Biden looks to be more popular than Trump, locally, we have Trump more popular than Biden. Whether you live in Vigo County or you live in the state of Indiana, there's a lot of red counties and a lot of Trump support in the state. And so that's their surrounding, a peripheral voter, that is. That's their surrounding, whether it be Trump flags, the Trump yard signs, and they go shopping, whether grocery store, Rural King, something like that. They interact with people who like Trump. And so that's the world now that we live in. But it'll be something else in 4 years, and a peripheral voter may have to decide or be influenced by something else.
So then it's fair to say that peripheral voters kind of go with maybe not the flow, but a flow. And is it fair then also to say that Vigo County may have a good number of peripheral voters?
I have made that argument for sure before. I thought that we do have a good base of Democrats and Republicans here in the county, as I mentioned before, right? This partisan split. But to be a good bellwether, you would need a high number of peripheral voters, I would say. In addition to an evenly split party ID makeup, peripheral voters are those that seem like they determine the outcome. Because we're so evenly divided in the nation, and we see that at least since 2000, we've seen such razor-thin margins of victories between the two presidential candidates that peripheral voters or independent voters
I don't want to use those two terms interchangeably, but, you know, think of them as a grouping. They seem like they're making election outcomes based off of where they lean. Just 8%, just 10% of the country are really undecided in that last month or last few weeks of the election day. And it seems like, so because the partisans are so evenly divided, they're making a big difference in the election outcome.
In the last 30 seconds or so that we have, what do you think of this moment, this sort of historic moment where Vigo County got it wrong for the third time in 130 years?
Well, if I were to say what's going to happen over the next 100 years, I have a feeling that Vigo County is going to be just like every other county, where sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong, and it's about a coin flip. So the future of Vigo County's bellwether status doesn't look bright to me. I see the country changing dramatically in demographics and Vigo County remaining fairly stable. And I see a national political landscape that's just going to particularly favor Democrats in the future when it comes to electoral college votes and Latino connections, that and the state still be remaining Republican for at least 10 or 15 years.
Matt Bergbauer is a professor of political science at Indiana State University, which is, of course, located in Vigo County. Matt, thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, a look back at 2016 and the appeal from then-President-elect Trump to the Carrier Corporation to keep its manufacturing jobs in Indianapolis. Did that and other efforts by the Trump administration work to preserve or increase manufacturing in Indiana? A conversation with our business reporter next. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2016, then-President-elect Donald Trump promised to save manufacturing in the United States. One of the companies he focused on was Carrier, whose Indianapolis manufacturing plant had announced earlier that year that it would be moving production to Mexico. Trump announced a deal with Carrier shortly after the 2016 election that would keep some jobs in Indianapolis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's business reporter Samantha Horton joins us now to share what manufacturing in Indiana looks like now. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So your story focuses on the Carrier plant. Where is that?
So the Carrier plant I focused on for this story is located on the west side of Indianapolis.
What's still happening there? Is it still the Carrier plant?
Yeah, so the Carrier plant's still there and it's still operating. It just has fewer workers there than back in 2016. So, I mean, they offshored about 600 jobs. And actually, in the past couple of years here, they actually have added 100 jobs at the facility. And it's been pretty busy, at least as of the moment.
So I guess it's still a net loss of manufacturing jobs compared to early 2016 when they announced moving operations to Mexico?
That is correct, Matt. Yes, that's still a net loss of roughly 500 jobs.
What about businesses near the plant? Have the changes that happened at the Carrier plant affected the entire area around it?
So I actually met with a former Carrier worker outside what used to be Sully's Bar and Grill. Now it's has a new name. It's the West Side Pub, I believe, and it's just under new ownership. He pointed to what used to be a barber shop that's no longer a barber shop, and it's this little strip mall that's, you could see the Carrier plant right across the street. He described that was the place that people from Carrier would go. People from another plant that has since closed, Rexnord, would go as well. So he's described it as when the jobs like his left, it obviously. He, at least from his perspective, impacted these businesses then that were right there.
So his job was one of the ones lost. How's he doing?
So, yeah, his name's Dwayne, and he worked for Carrier for about 5 years before being laid off. He's now currently taking classes to become a home inspector. But while he's taking the classes, he's working part-time jobs. And so I asked how easily has he been able to rebound from what he was being paid for at Carrier, you know, to the temp jobs. And he's really described it as it's been a huge financial hit.
Does he blame the president for losing his job in any way?
He does not blame Trump for losing his job. He looks almost at the previous administration, so the Obama administration, and believes that this Trump did what he could do is honestly what Duane believes. And glad that Trump made the effort he did and saved at least some of the jobs. However, he does believe Trump could do more.
Let's take a look at what the president has done while in office. Have his policies brought manufacturing back to the U.S. in the way that he had hoped?
At least from what the expert, Michael Hicks, I talked to for this, no. You look at the trade war that started in summer of 2018. Since then, when Hicks looked at the numbers, Indiana actually in 2019, I guess the first full year that the U.S. would have been that trade war, Indiana actually had for the first time since the Great Recession, had a net loss of manufacturing jobs in the state. Can you source everything back to the policies? Not necessarily. But at the same time, there are some correlations there you can almost look at and be like, have these policies helped keep jobs here? And I think that's what some have argued. They haven't necessarily helped and encouraged jobs, manufacturing jobs, to stay here or even possibly come back.
You spoke with Chuck Jones, the union president who famously sparred with Trump over Twitter in 2016. What did he say?
So, yeah, Chuck has had an extensive career himself in manufacturing. About 50 years, he worked at the Rexnord plant, which is just down the road from the Cary facility, and it fully packed up and moved those jobs to Monterrey, Mexico. He is grateful for Trump for saving the jobs he did. He's just frustrated that it wasn't as transparent. The president wasn't as transparent as he felt he should have been, and felt that maybe he could have had a little bit more respect had he just been fully honest. With that being said, Chuck, you know, with his long career in manufacturing, he actually doesn't recommend people going into manufacturing anymore. He doesn't see the industry as stable maybe as it was when he got out of high school and started working himself in manufacturing. He recommends people going into trades or other avenues for careers.
As much as President Trump seems to want to save manufacturing in the U.S., do we know how possible that is or what it would look like if it were to happen?
So this is a really good question, Matt, because I think it's a lot of trying to learn and understand what will manufacturing look like in the U.S. in the next 5, 10, you name it, how many years? It's changing, absolutely. And I think the big question now is, when Trump says he wants to save manufacturing, what does that really mean? We're seeing manufacturing jobs still leave. And in a globally competitive market, that's something that's going to be hard for a president or for anyone to really control. Yeah, there are policies that you could put in place that would maybe incentivize companies to keep jobs here. Maybe it's even like looking at government contracts. Who do you contract with? Are they companies that have the jobs here in the U.S.? There's things that you could possibly do, but you can't fully stop a company necessarily from deciding to move jobs out of the U.S. to another country, such as Mexico or China. People have to understand, when companies are looking at their bottom line and trying to be competitive in their costs, Michael Hicks gave the example of an iPhone. If all the parts and pieces for an iPhone were made here in the U.S., paid with the, you know, salaries that we're talking about that are competitive, and you're looking at an iPhone that would cost somewhere between like possibly $5,000 to $6,000. That's just not competitive in the market we're in now, definitely when we have a global economy.
We've been talking a lot about efforts at the federal level, but what has Indiana done to keep or gain manufacturing jobs?
So for Carrier, at least, there was a lot of incentives, even on the state level, tax incentives. That's usually a part of my reporting whenever I talk about a company who decides to come to the state. And while there's been a big focus in the state about we're bringing jobs here, we're bringing them here, obviously we are losing jobs too. And I think that's the part that we have to really, when talking with, you know, workers that were laid off, talking with experts, it becomes very clear that while it might be touted that we're bringing these jobs here, there's this disconnect, this idea that communities might invest so much in a manufacturing. Manufacturing has usually, at least in the past, been maybe seen more as a staple and a more pillar in a community and relying on those jobs. And that's maybe not necessarily how we should be looking at it. When I talked to Hicks, that's kind of how he described it, is these jobs maybe aren't as reliable maybe as they maybe were in the past. If one takes a manufacturing job somewhere and that company ends up moving those jobs to somewhere else in the world, that person then has the tools and skills to be able to then go to another manufacturing place and start working there. I think that's the key there, is realizing how do you make sure your workforce is able to recover when these companies leave.
Samantha Horton is Indiana Public Broadcasting's business reporter. Sam, thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
And now a look at the small number of education referendums that were on Indiana ballots this past Tuesday. Our education reporter Jeannie Lindsay is with us. Hi, Jeannie.
Hello.
So remind us how many referendums were up to the voters and where they were.
Right. So this fall, there were only 4 referendums on the ballot. That's a pretty small number. It's the smallest group we've seen since 2014. But generally speaking, we see fewer referendums proposed in the fall compared to the spring. And that's definitely true this year. We had more than a dozen schools proposing a lot of referendums this June. So 4 is definitely a big shift. And those referendums were for Gary Community School Corporation. There was Bremen Public Schools in Marshall County. There was Wawasee Schools and then Southeast Du Bois County Community Schools.
Which ones passed?
So all of them passed except for one. So Wawasee was the only one that failed. About 2/3 of voters rejected that referendum. The others won by pretty comfortable margins. The Southeast Du Bois referendum and the Bremen Schools referendum both passed with more than 70% of voters voting yes. And then in Gary, for the Gary Community School Corporation, that was also a comfortable margin. Not quite as big, but 60% about voters approved that one. So mostly successful, but one did fail.
Well, let's start with that one, the one that failed, Wawasee, and dig into it. What was that going to go toward?
Yeah, so I talked with the superintendent, and he said that funding would have gone towards a fund to support school resource officers. So it would go towards, you know, a stable fund for school safety. He also talked about it going towards career technical education and improving instruction, which has been on the minds of a lot of school leaders, especially now with the pandemic going on, where everyone's rethinking instruction. Unfortunately, that referendum did not pass. So now he is going back to kind of the drawing board a little bit and looking at what changes need to be made because that funding won't be available.
I understand, though, that the superintendent seemed at least gracious for the consideration. How did he respond once it failed to pass?
Yeah, and he was really, you know, just appreciative for the community, you know, listening to the messaging. You know, he definitely said that there were places that, you know, he could have messaged a little bit better about the referendum, but he was appreciative for everyone who voted on it, paying attention to a critical issue like school funding. So he was really grateful that the community was, you know, there listening and the people who voted on it, even if they, you know, didn't agree with the referendum per se. He basically said that this message from the community is one that he's going to listen to. You know, he's going to go into the budget and see where they can trim without cutting programs for students and hopefully, you know, avoiding that type of thing. But, you know, he did say that he's going to take this message and go back to the budget and look and see what he has to do, because he's got to do what he can with the funds that are available now.
Okay, so that one failed. The rest of them passed. Let's focus on the really big one, Gary. So why was the passage of that referendum so important to the district?
Yeah, so Gary Community School Corporation has been under state management since 2017. And there are a lot of people up in that community that are not happy about that. They want to, you know, be the people who are running their schools, you know, have that done locally. So this referendum was a really big deal because the takeover was in part spurred by the budget crisis up there. So the manager, you know, sent out a statement and said, now that this referendum money has been approved, you know, the school corporation is on the fastest track to get out from underneath state control. And so that's really exciting for the people who live there and who send their kids to those schools. And so that funding is going to be really critical in balancing the budget. Also paying teachers more. I mean, over the past couple of years, especially, we've been hearing a lot about, you know, teacher compensation around the state. So other than, you know, returning this school corporation back to the community, you know, this referendum will also go towards raising teacher pay, which is a pretty big deal.
Well, let's look at that related issue. I mean, the Indiana General Assembly promised to review teacher pay during the 2021 session. That's a budget session. But that promise came before the pandemic. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so we still haven't heard from the governor's teacher compensation commission. They have talked about, you know, before the pandemic, they talked about a set of recommendations they would send off to lawmakers about how to improve teacher compensation. But you're right. I mean, that was all talked about before the pandemic, and Indiana has faced a sharp decline in a lot of revenue streams, and definitely agencies have already been making cuts. And so the state lawmakers, they're going to have to come back in January and figure out how much money they really can and want to offer to schools with such limited money on hand from this year. So it'll definitely be a lot of interest in that, especially from school leaders. And, you know, when we're talking about school funding and referendum proposals, I mean, those are really critical for schools. They don't offer those lightly usually. So looking at especially, you know, the Wawasee referendum and the Future for Gary, that's really going to be a critical time for schools and, you know, what support they get from the state and, you know, what support they may or may not get from the federal government for additional emergency aid, which a lot of leaders in schools have been talking about and talking about that they need.
Let's get back to the referendum. Southeast Du Bois was another one that passed. Where's that extra money going?
Yeah, so that kind of gets back to the you know, the importance of revenue. The superintendent there, Jamie Pund, I talked with her the day after the election, and she said that this referendum funding is going to help them avoid cuts. So, you know, their revenue has been on the decline. Their enrollment has been declining a bit. So she said that this really is going to be really helpful to avoid some of those hard cuts that, you know, potentially were on the table.
And I understand Bremen Public Schools referendum was pretty modest compared to the other two that passed, but still pretty significant. What was it for?
Yeah, the superintendent at Bremen, Jim White, told me that he has, you know, more than 1,400 kids enrolled in his school corporation and just one nurse. And that is very off of the recommended ratio of one nurse to 500 students. So this money, you're right, it was only 6 cents on the $100 of assessed property value. So definitely not a big tax ask. But he said that that funding will go towards hiring more nurses, more school counselors to deal with some of the things that right now is going to other people who, you know, might not necessarily have the training or all the resources to provide that sort of support to students and to staff. So mental health and guidance counselors are pretty high priority for that.
Governor Holcomb was, of course, reelected on Tuesday, and he will now appoint the first state education secretary. Has he given any indication on who he's looking for that position?
Yeah, I wish. we have asked him, and we've all been asking for any sort of, you know, clear indication or shortlist or anything like that. And, you know, he's talked about the characteristics for who he would want in that job. You know, he wants someone who is not going to need a bunch of extra training or, you know, has to get used to it. So he's looking for someone with experience, but he hasn't offered any names or anything like that. He did say before the election that he would wait until after the outcome to, you know, start really looking into some of the recommendations and suggestions he's received from folks. But yeah, as of right now, we don't know. So definitely waiting to hear on that.
Jeannie Lindsay reports on education for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. Download our free smartphone app, All In Vox Pop, so you can chime in when we're live and send us high-quality audio messages to share on the show. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.